Crowe's pity was registration with council. It's now enrolment with council, and I think that committee agreed. We had discussion about that yesterday. The only thing perhaps in clause 31B, the application for enrollment must be accompanied by the fee and indicate whether the applicant intends to practice as an attorney or an advocate, and in the case of an advocate, whether he or she intends to practice without a fidelity fund certificate. I think that's an important difference. And then subclause 3 puts to the role of legal practitioners. Enrolled must have A, the particulars of practicing and non-practicing legal practitioners, in the case of advocates, whether they practice with or without a fidelity fund certificate. And then clause paragraph G requires attorneys who get right of appearance in the High Courts, Superior Courts, their particulars must also be included in the role. And then there was quite a bit of a discussion. I go now to subclause 6, which reads the role must be published on the website of the council, updated every month by the council, and be available for inspection by members of the public during business hours of the council and regional councils. Question arose there on accessibility, and one of the questions was, should it not be published in the Government Gazette? I think that might be quite an expensive option. We were asked to get some particulars about that, and from the information we received from the government printer, the costs per page to publish in the Gazette is approximately 600 Rand per page. So the financial implications for the council could be considerable as far as that's concerned. If you just make mention that the Register of Debt Collectors, and I remember doing that a few years ago in this committee, they've also got to publish their register, and that's done on the website purely for financial reasons. New clause, I think people go to websites more than government gazetting any of it. Clause 31, Chair, cancellation, suspension, enrollment. And the committee asked us here to split what was originally paragraph A and B. Originally it said the council must cancel or suspend the enrollment of a legal practitioner at the High Court, order his or her name to be struck with the role. The council must, before any such cancellation, notify the legal practitioner. I think it was the LSSA said, why must you notify the legal practitioner? If the High Court does that, then the legal practitioner would have known about it. So the council may only cancel or suspend and notify the legal practitioner in the case of paragraph B, where the legal practitioner was enrolled erroneously in the first place. The rest of the amendments in that clause relate to registration vis-a-vis enrollment and are consequential. So if I may move on to clause 32. Month by council, but yes, maybe we need to.
I would imagine you can't just do it.
If you decide to stop practicing, you can just stop practicing.
Typically, it's not supposed to.
Without informing council.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I suppose you have at some point when you're identified identity funds, mm-hmm. but should there not become time limits within which you should notify? Mm-hmm.
Can I just give you the position? You choose to stop practicing, and you can put your name onto the non-practicing attorney's role, mm-hmm. which is held by counsel. Mm-hmm. I remember I had done that one stage. Mm-hmm. So, you want to remain registered as an attorney, not as a sister.
But
there isn't, yeah.
Chair, maybe sub-clause 4 in clause 31. Council must, at the written request of a legal practitioner, cancel his or her enrolment and remove his name from the role. Clause 31. 4. 31, 4. Clause 31, 4. We'll have to make provision for the non-practicing. There is provision for removal, but not from conversion. Continue, Chair. Clause 32 deals with conversion of enrollment and is consequential to what we've already discussed. The terminology. Authority to render legal services. May I just point to the footnote that is there. The committee indicated that in its eventual report to the National Assembly, reference should be made to the comments of the Competition Commission regarding inclusion of paralegals in the bill, as well as in-house lawyers and state agents. I mentioned that in passing. The other proposed amendment is in subclause 3, no person may, in expectation of any fee, commission, gain or reward, directly or indirectly perform any acts or render any service by a legal practitioner. That's adapted in line with the comments we received from the SSA, and as far as I recall, was agreed to by the portfolio committee. Clause 34, forms of legal practice. We've dealt with particularly subclause 2 yesterday. An attorney may render legal services in expectation of a fee, as contemplated in this act or any other applicable law. This is coupled to the question that arose to cover the, you referred to any other applicable law to cover the contingency fees act as requested by the committee. Chair, I've been through subclause 2. I don't know whether the committee wants me to go through it again. That barely deals with, this is the crucial clause which allows advocates to take briefs directly from members of the public and also accommodates Legal Aid South Africa's concern. Second. Yeah, I think all the regulations, we've been talking about this audit that we had to do at the end of the process, and I wonder whether that wouldn't be included in that audit, and maybe the audit should also have a look at, spell out for the committee, possibly in a table form, in terms of the bill as it reads now, what is required to be done by way of rules, what is required to be done by way of regulations, and then to interrogate what needs to change. I just put that forward as a suggestion.
May I just suggest that the default position is the council making rules, and I think that if by way of the right exception, then it will be a case of ministerial regulation. In the particular case of the relaxation of the referral rules, it should clearly be the rules made by the council. I mean, it is an example of a bar rule being changed that must be changed by the profession, and the profession is recognized that can make the rule and lift it. But it's a bar rule that is being changed.
We impose an obligation by statute, but how it's done, it should be done by the country.
Supreme Court case, I think it's Rosamund or De Francis, where the Supreme Court of Appeal was reluctant to change the bar rules and said even the legislature, even questioned whether the legislature should change the bar rules when it comes to direct briefings. That's just a caution. I'm sure it can, but there is that caution that was expressed as well against the background of the independence of the profession and that whole argument. But it's something we can look at. Just bear in mind. That's the first point. The second point on this is, if this briefing directed by members of the public, now we know the biggest litigant is the state. What happens with the state? Do they still work with the state attorney? Are they covered? We're opening a whole gambit there, because ideally the state should operate as a state attorney that decides whether to litigate further, and whether it's in the interests of the state to settle a matter early, treasury instructions, treasury regulations apply. But already many state departments already directly brief advocates where for opinions, I think. Even I know in the case they go straight to an advocate for an opinion. So I think we need to just bear in mind the whole issue of the state being a litigant as well, that is impacted by what you are doing here as well.
I think that's an excellent point. Let me give you verbatim the point Steve referred to in the first place. What the FEA, this is just Judge Jules Pierre in the main judgment on the fact that it is not for us, that's the court. It would have been through the referral rules, nor would it be appropriate for the legislature to do so. The rules have been defined by the bars for practice in the divided profession in order to plan the public interest. It should be left to them to consider what extent change is required, though the courts will be a final arbiter of the validity. He said no one should interfere because, but listen to this, because it would bring us out of step with the other Commonwealth countries, and that is incorrect. And it was exactly Judge Cameron's point. In fact, the whole court, Malcolm Wallace appeared, the usual arguments about the antiquity of the old rules that we don't disturb them because they are so old. And the judge then said, but hang on, can we have some comparative jurisdiction examples? And it turned out, of course, that the comparative jurisdictions have done all sorts of things. England relaxed the referral rule for the specialist litigation practices. At that point, Advocate Wallace abandoned, as he then was, abandoned the entire argument. So judge here is, of course, with respect, respecting very great Rob, and in saying that it would bring us out of tempers, comparable Commonwealth. Our dilemma is that 15 years after Judge Cameron urged the bar on an urgent basis to look at the referral rule, they haven't touched it. They don't think to touch it. And that's why it's part of our argument that within the doctrine of legality, there must be cases where justifiably we can by statute say, but this now because it must be relaxed, but you as well are going to do the relaxing.
Talking to my colleague,
we say the referral rule is done away with. Members of the public can brief advocates directly, and the those be directed by members of the public. What about the state? Should, first of all, have we thought about whether the state should be able to brief advocates directly? If so, then it's not covered at the moment. I haven't got a view on it yet because I'm not sure if it's desirable or not. If it's not desirable, then the present formulation is correct. So it's something we might need to just think about and canvas further, because know that the whole issue of legal service to the state has been re-looked at by the department. So it might be an issue that is raised at a later stage, the whole issue of how we do the chief litigation officer and all that type of thing. But should there be provision in this Act for the state to be able to brief the advocate directly? And if that is so, then would that not make the state attorney office redundant? So that's the double-edged sword. We just need to think about that.
So that would be, if we need something along those lines, it would be an exemption like we got in paragraph C for the legal aid South Africa, is that what? Because we're making an exemption for legal aid South Africa in terms of paragraph C, the alternative there, to be able to brief advocates without going through.
But I'm not sure about the desirability of that. I think that's what the department needs to consider that first. Whether it's desirable or not is a separate issue.
Yes, this is what I just pointed out. The department is working on this area, and I don't have all the details. I would like to, if I may, just go back and what I am aware is that there is a move to try and get all state departments to work through the state attorney as it should be. And I think to put something in like that would be counterproductive. That's what theoretically the case should be, but in practice, I don't think it's. Where a criminal department cannot some way the reason use the state attorney, but that by way of exception. The general in the English department should use the state attorney to brief counsel. And Solicitor General.
Services and expectations of the from a justice into that service. Upon reading this clause, it talks about legal services, which is not just criminal matters. Okay, but if you look at the footnote 1.5, it's specifically example. The justice center is defined in clause 1 as an office of legal aid in South Africa, including a settled office, okay. This insertion is at the request of Lasa, which requests Lasa be exempted from the requirement of an attorney having to brief an advocate in criminal matters. And as far as I know, it currently is only criminal matters. Now, I also know that legal aid do civil matters as well, even though not as big as or as many as criminal matters. So what matters are we talking about here in this? In the bill, and isn't that maybe a way of this whole thing about the referral rule of extending LASA's act and then put all sorts of things in there, and then obviously because currently criminal matters are being covered for, and I don't know if advocates are also doing civil matters for legal aid, even though legal aid is doing civil matters for the public.
I think that's also a good point, Matt. We were requested to do this on the basis of criminal matters. So maybe it was just loose wording that needs to be tightened up, and I would like to do that in conjunction with Legal Aid South Africa. We did send this proposal through to them. We haven't had a response, but it does give effect to what they said. It might need to be tightened up to a request based on the challenges they experience in criminal matters where they want this exemption. So as I said, if I may go back to shortly later, so then we comment. Move on,
Jeff. Yes.
Just something else. Sorry, Chairperson. Okay. Clause 34 again. 2B123 on page 41.
Right,
yes. I think it's not supposed to be notified. I think it's old. As in, yeah, because that's section 31B2 talks about enrollment at the council and not notification.
Council and the council must enroll. And that's really a technical amendment. I think for making it easier to read, that the council must determine rules relating to the briefing of advocates by attorneys, paragraph A, B, directly by members of the public, and C, instruction of attorneys. This is a proposal that was made, not that splitting up as the provision has been done, but the proposal comes, I think, from the GCB, that council must also make rules relating to briefing of advocates directly by members of the public. Thank you. Yes. To include Legal Aid South Africa.
Really what we were asking about now in B2 in a way. Because in B2 we then complied with regulations the minister must make. And we said it shouldn't be issued to the council, which is exactly what it is in 3.
Yeah.
I think there's a difference here. Maybe Mr. Fleur could assist the rules that
I'm constrained to provide an opinion in a certain way. No, can we flag this? Can you please flag this? There is a specific reason why we wanted to put it in. We'll just check whether it's a duplication of some sort. And please allow us to do that just to come out.
It almost seems to me that we're actually asking truth, because we're saying in 3 that the rules have been made as to direct briefing, but yet they made it a requirement for advocates to receive direct briefing that they have to have complied. Now, what happens in the instance that they could brief, they wouldn't have. So, you know, all you need really is to say that they must comply with 1.3, and then the rules will be put in place as to how they turn off.
There is turn, I just can't recall. I think the regulations deal with, let me come back. Okay. But we did speak about this internally and I raised the same question and I can't recall. Then we go into subclause 4. It sets out the ways in which attorneys may practice for their own account as part of a juristic entity, as part of a non-juristic entity. And the committee asked us, I think some of the commentators made the point, that attorneys must also be able to practice as part of a law clerk established in terms of subsection 8. And the same principle applies for advocates, which we have done in subclause 5. Advocates may also practice as part of a law clerk established in terms of subsection 8. The committee...
That's
legal
aid
then
covered by the
non-profit
jurisdiction.
Legal aid is dealt with... And the committee directly raised the question, what do we mean by public interest legal centre? And there were some comments to that effect as well. It's not used in the law and we should possibly delete it here. And we've done so. There were no amendments in subclause 6. In subclause 7, a law clinic, the words being inserted, a law clinic may be established by a non-profit juristic entity to conduct a legal practice. This deals with 7, yes. A law clinic may be established by a non-profit juristic entity. No, 7, the inclusion of these words in subclause 7 We had a look at the, we were asked to have a look at LRC's comments, and we had a discussion with LRC as well. And one of the issues that was raised telephonically by the LRC, in a holistic approach, is that we must include a law clinic maybe established by a non-profit juristic entity to conduct a legal practice, provided that its founding, that in terms of its founding documents, its chairperson and the majority of members of its governing body comprised of legal practitioners in accordance with rules determined by the council. Maybe I should just take it back to the definition of a law clinic. A law clinic means, that's in clause 1A, a centre for the practical legal education of students in the law faculty of, in the faculty of law at a university, or a law centre controlled by or which is a non-profit making organisation and provides legal services to the public free of charge.
I'll just clarify, you're proposing to put that in, this one in our draft.
How wonderful. This is in 34.7. Sorry, remember, Chair, yesterday I said there were a few additions that I made during the course of the night, and that's one of them in 7. So what is inserted is law clinic may be established by a non-profit juristic entity, and that sort of aligns with the definition of law clinic. And this is pursuant to conversation that we had with one of the representatives of Legal Resources Centre, as we were asked to do. The other issue there, the committee raised a provision 7A, required the members of the governing body of a non-profit juristic entity to be comprised exclusively of legal practitioners. The committee raised the questions whether that rule could not be relaxed. In our discussion with LRC, it was also indicated that it might be a good idea to relax that rule. So it hasn't been relaxed in the case of commercial juristic entities, but at the request of the committee, it has been relaxed. The chairperson and majority of the members of the governing body must be legal practitioners. And there's a backup there as well, but that must be determined by the rules of council.
On 5E, the state advocate issue, are we going to do away with the fusion of the bar and the fire bar? Because that's the trigger. Because, as we know, state attorneys can be advocates as well. You remember that? Because that's going to be done by.
I think that is, I'll have to go and check up there. That's a very obscure provision, Mr. Swarton, that I discovered.
When? When
is
it all
closed? Oh,
as it's gone.
As it's gone.
There's a provision that allows, in terms of the Advocates Act, that says to become an advocate you must have your name removed from the attorney's role, except in the case of state attorney. So I would presume that will then fall away because those acts are being repealed and there's not a similar provision in this legislation. So we're doing away with fusion of the bar and the
side. Yes, we discovered that by accident, and I don't confirm, was it in the Admission of Advocates Act or was it in the State Attorney Act? Because if it's in the Advocates Act, then it will be done away. If it's in the State Attorney Act, then the State Attorney Act is not being done away. And it is being done away with.
Did you look at the Honourable Gum one day and start wondering? Oh, wonderful.
I think many about that. It was a very big surprise for me as well. That it was absolutely obscure little funnily worded provision in the admission of advocate.
That any person who has been admitted by the High Court and authorized to be enrolled might be regarded as. So there is a transitional provision.
Attorneys who can only call themselves attorneys after they've been through all the processes and been admitted. The same will apply to advocates. They will have to be in through all the processes, and they will only be admitted as advocates after they've done the foundational training and the bar exam, for want of a better word.
It's not me officially to comment on this matter, but there's going to be a mysterious phenomenon in South Africa where very many people change their titles.
Oh.
No,
it's
not take away this.
This is true, but are you, sounds very
interesting. But they're not that one.
The attorneys ever are addressed with it's Mr.
That should be called Mr.
Yes, certainly.
What do you mean? In court, the judges refer to counsel as Mr. or Miss.
Oh.
They are never, ever, ever addressed by any other name.
Well, an attorney, why should they be addressed by the other name?
This practice is developed to have a prefix for the title of counsel. It probably is Mr. They refer to as Mr. or Miss. No, sir. As Mr.
Oh, okay.
Honorable?
Take up office.
offices there and represent them. But then what is the difference between that and commercial banks? Because that was the argument that was raised at that time, and then there was, I still don't understand that a bit, but in any event, the argument was that the attorneys are not independent if they, yes. So what is the difference between a bank and a law clinic and a non-profit juristic entity then if it comes to the same thing?
The difference is that the law clinic doesn't have sides to take with the public interest body. It represents everybody. The bank is the bank, and it has its own peculiar interest. So these law clinics represent the public interest bodies. And that's the difference.
And I think to add on to that is they can appear in court where if you've got a legal advisor and a bank doesn't have rights, if you work as a legal advisor for a bank, doesn't have rights.
Okay.
I have it correctly. It takes us to paragraph F of subclause 7. Upon its winding up, dissolution or voluntary deregistration, Ms. Lowe discovered that that's another way of dissolving a non-privileged juristic entity in terms of the Non-Profit Organisations Act. So we're just accommodating something that's already in legislation. Then we go to subclause 8, which deals with law clinics established by a university in the Republic. There are not any real substantial changes there, except the inclusion of paragraph H, and the footnote that says that's the comments of the LSSA in respect of 34, clause 34H. They argue that section 3 of the Attorney's Act currently requires a law clinic to be accredited by the Council of the Law Society before that law clinic may engage candidate attorneys. I don't know, I can't recall to put it in, I can't recall what the committee's attitude to that inclusion was when we discussed the comments, but I've got a suspicion that there was tentative agreement that we could include that. It just retains the current situation that all societies must accredit for purposes of purposes of candidate attorneys. For the making of regulations by the Minister for the creation and recognition of limited liability legal practices and the terms and conditions applicable to such practices. And where it was may, we have inserted must, because I've got a sense there was a strong feeling that regulations must be made in consultation with the Council on this aspect, recognition, creation and recognition of limited liability legal practices.
I know that argued strongly for a change in the current regime, and we should do more than we're currently doing. I've got the impression it was in regards to alternative business structures and the like.
Yes.
I don't recall her strong motivation for limited liability practices, because what this does, and I feel it's misplaced to actually go to the other part that she was arguing for, this is a very peculiar structure that you actually need quite a bit of investigation. I know that bigger law firms only were requesting this in line with international practices because of all of these massive mergers and acquisitions and the billions of dollars that are flowing in those transactions, and they will want to note their liability. And it was peculiar, really, in that instance, and I didn't remember that we wanted to have a must for this, but I understood the must to come under the other the alternative business structures, and really looked at that whole issue. That was my recollection.
I'm glad you got it wrong, I must confess.
Yeah.
It might be, as Mr. Dyer is saying, misplaced, and if you go to sub-clause 11, maybe that's where I include the clause there to say that the council must investigate and make recommendations to the Minister on creation of other forms of legal practice and the statutory recognition of paralegals, taking into account best international practices of public interest and interests of the legal profession, with a view to legislative and other intervention in order to improve access to the legal profession and access to justice generally. And the footnote there says, is for the consideration of the committee at its suggestion that a provision be inserted to empower the Minister to consider new forms of legal practice, including paralegals in the future. Is that small in line with, I apologise, I think it's Adam Sam.
Chairman, yes, as a first instance, I would say that this is an example where the council is supposed to do the inquiry and the recommendation, but I would think that it is a case where the minister should, by regulation, give the final effect, simply because we are here anyway legislating forms of legal practice, and what we're looking for is further forms of legal practice which are responsive inter alia to international developments and the big trade instruments. The trade and services. And so I think that's right. But Mr. Dyer remembers absolutely correctly, the limited liability provisions, I was simply inquiring what is it, what's it for, etc. Is Mr. Dyer now saying through you, Chair, that we should in fact fold that into sub 11? If it is something that is precisely the result of multinational legal work or transborder legal work, then maybe it does sit very nicely there. Mm. No, I think 9 then bites the dust. And what happens is that they have limited liability legal practice, don't even have to mention those things. What you do is you retain 11. But if, you see, if a limited liability legal practice is one of the examples of forms of legal practice, which should be looked at. Yeah. I mean, you can absolutely must. You can refer to them as well. But then we should refer to other things as well, multidisciplinary practices and all the other things that now appear only sporadically down there. And I mean, what are they? I mean, modernization is going to happen anyway. But it's the multidisciplinaries, it's the limited legal abilities, what's the other? Correct. Oh yes. Yeah. Of the two professions. Yeah, that's the one that I think now here's I think is like a legitimacy as a regulator sitting together there's the thing that they can look at together. They both have a direct interest. Yeah, that's right. So maybe we should in fact make a little list under 11. We say as a council must within 2 or 3 years investigate and make recommendations to the minister on the creation of other forms of legal practice, including limited liability, multidisciplinary, etc.
Chairperson, the recommendations would be no, also.
Sure.
You know, so we're not forcing anything.
Yes. Yes.
Yes. Yes.
Sure.
procedural step, if I may proceed. The committee requested us to put in a penalty provision for any person. I think it was directed more at advocates who take briefs directly from the public without having a fidelity fund certificate. So that's what this is about. But maybe we couched it in broader terms so that any legal practitioner or person who contravenes, not necessarily subsection 2, but any other provision is guilty of an offence, that goes broader than subsection 2. Mm-hmm. But the question is raised, and I put it in the footnote, this might not be necessary because there is already a penalty clause in clause 84.4. We put it in because the committee requested it, but if you have a look at clause 84.4, any person who contravenes 844, any person who contravenes subsections 1 or 2, now subsections 1 or 2 deal with trust monies, and maybe our penalty clause for contravention of section 34 could rather be included in clause 844 than having a specific penalty provision in clause 34.
Anyone have any objection to that? And you happy with the 2 years sanction?
The penalty clauses that we're talking about here relate to trust monies and that sort of thing. In clause 33, we're dealing with authority. We could put anything, but then the penalty clause in clause 33 won't fit well in clause 84 because they're dealing with different things. Unless we create a specific penalty clause.
I'm not sure why we're saying 2 years, no more than 2 years, or because there's some of these provisions that put us that far reaching, if you don't understand. What's the reason to say about it?
Take it off?
Well, no, I'm going to take it out. But, I mean, if someone takes a free story and doesn't have a fidelity certificate, and it involves taking large deposits or something like that, and then disappeared. 2 years enough?
Well, that's question one.
But then it would be set to what?
That's no. I would imagine.
Do we have the jurisdiction of this bill to determine what the court of law is going to impose? This time?
No, that's not what Mrs. Shen is saying. The example she gave was
thinking aloud. So that it should be a deterrent. Mm-hmm. Why should we not approach it? Or why was it not approached it in the sense of putting a minimum sentence? Is that a question? Because it must have a current detect legal practitioners instead of putting a tax, put a minimum.
Mind that there'd be a combination of charges.
Mm.
This charge is purely for the aspect of not having a fidelity fund. If there is money missing, that would be an additional charges for that, plus the disciplinary action that will take place. So maybe, you know, so I'm sure there was a lot of discussion around the issue of 2 years, that is the maximum. If one wants to increase it, you're still giving the courts the discretion up to that amount. That's what happened with all those adverts in Pretoria with the RAF matters. They were struck off, they've got no income, that's a massive penalty. And that will be taken into consideration, the disciplinary action, if it's 5 months, will be taken into consideration when the criminal cases is heard in mitigation, aggravation of sentence as well. So, something we can come back to, but I don't think we should have minimum sentences here. One can look at that the maximum is there of 2 years.
A matter of interest on this, in the Attorneys Act, Section 8310 provides that any person who directly or indirectly purports to act as a practitioner or to practice on his own account or in partnership without being in possession of a fidelity fund on conviction liable to fine not exceeding 2,000 rand, 6 months imprisonment.
Is that covered in this bill? People who act as if they are those and they're not. They're not even vaguely qualified, but they run around pretending to be attorneys. Is that covered?
What clause 30, the penalty clause in 34, 33, 4 is about the chair. No. 33.2 talks about a person may not hold himself or herself out of the legal practitioner.
What the hell is on you?
Chairperson, if we go to 33.1 and read the whole section, we see 1A, appear in a court or tribunal, draw up or issue any instrument or document. Mm-hmm. That guides us as to where this is, and if you perceive gain reward within that, in a contention. So that would, you know, naturally include that legal. They can't do that. I mean, attorney.
Chair, can I just add on to this discussion? Long ago in the bill, there was a definition for legal services also, and along the way it was taken out for this exact reason, because a lot of the things such as wills can be done by anyone, it is done by banks, etc. So it was decided, you know, not to specify, but except for these that are in the book, court proceedings and appearance. Everything else can be done, but an obviously notary and conveyancing work is specified. Yeah, so that is the paralegal supporting that element.
Proposal there, and the department was requested to have a look at an alternative option in terms of which the rules board is used to determine fees. And the option here, maybe I should read it, fees in respect of legal services, maybe, and I'm just, this is read for clarity, I don't know whether we should keep it in the provision. Litigious and non-litigious services rendered by legal practitioners, juristic entities, law clinics, or legal aid South Africa referred to in section 34 must be in accordance with the tariffs made by the Rules Board for course of law established by section 2 of that Act. The Rules Board must, when setting the tariffs as contemplated in subsection 1, take into account certain criteria. These criteria are in the original clause 35, with the exception of paragraph B, which we were included to insert, is seniority experience of the legal practitioner concerned as determined in this Act. So subclause 2 is really a criteria that we left in the original clause 35. The big difference is clause 35.1, which entitles or which empowers the Rules Board to set tariffs. The Rules Board already sets tariffs in respect of litigious matters, but not in respect of non-litigious matters. So that's in a nutshell what this provision is about. But Chair, if I may just point out, and I don't know whether I did it yesterday, the Rules Board is constrained. It only determines tariffs for the High Courts and the Supreme Court of Appeal and the Constitutional Court. It doesn't make and magistrates, of course, it doesn't set tariffs for the Constitutional Court and the Labour Court. This provision will require, if it is accepted, will require a consequential amendment to the Rules Board for Courts of Law Act. There is a tentative one, there is one that has been set out in the schedule to Act. You could have a look at that. But I think the biggest problem at the moment is that the Rules Board doesn't deal with the two courts of appeal.
Chair, obviously this is a big flagged issue, and there are a number of issues which we have raised in the past about accessibility, about demand, supply. I can understand the provision of tariffs for litigation, but I've got a major concern for non-contentious matters, or what they refer to, non-contentious matters. We've got attorney firms that are doing mergers and acquisitions internationally. how can our rules board that only deals with a limited amount of litigious matter, it doesn't even deal with constitutional court tariffs, how can they decide if you're doing a multi-billion dollar acquisition or merger, which is hiring commercial attorneys, whether that fee of $10 million is reasonable or not. So I would suggest that we should limit this to litigious matters, because that obviously is access to justice. When we're talking about other issues of legal advice, drafting of complex contracts, I don't think the rules board is in a position to advise on the applicability or the appropriateness or reasonableness of those fees. Now, Chair, I'm not a corporate lawyer, but I can understand that particularly when you start looking at multinationals and lawyers' firms giving advice to major mergers, how can that be determined by regulation? It's just a question that I think.
Now, let me just remind Mr. Swart that we specifically wanted some provision made for non-litigious fees and tariffs, because the rules board already does the litigious stuff. And it was in the course of trying to find a solution or a method or a modality or a mechanism to deal with this issue that somebody suggested the rules board, because it does already deal with tariffs, and we said, let's look at it. And our excellent advisors we're going to go away and think about it, and I think perhaps even speak to some people. So that's why it's here, what we asked. As to whether it is what we ought to have, that's a different question. And now, I've argued this morning, and I think before, that apart from these two approaches here, the first being that the regulator or set up some sort of a fee scheme, The third option, which I think is the thinking about, is to require counsel to go and do an inquiry, exactly as we've just done for alternative business structures in subsection 11 of the preceding clause, which was numbered what? 34. In 34.11, we are now going to ask them to investigate and make recommendations on the creation of other forms of legal practice. Now, I think we could also ask them to launch an inquiry, investigate or have investigated. The fee, it's more than a fee structure. It's the fee regime, the question of legal costs in South Africa. It's really the whole economics that I think that I should look at. And that inquiry should involve economists and competition authorities, perhaps. And then they must go back to either the council to make rules or to the minister to make recommendations. This is a case where one does not want the minister. One wants, in fact, council to make its own rules. So I think the third option, we should write a clause saying the Legal Practice Council must inquire into legal fees and your costs in South Africa, and bring recommendations and to itself. It must inquire into it and then make rules in order to ensure that South Africans can have access to legal services. But it must be phrased quite carefully, because what one is asking for is a full-scale economic inquiry. What is wrong with the economic? So that fully would be a third option. On the matter of people who in non-litigious work do work that carries very high fees, including the multinational, let me just remind Mr. Swart that whether Wentz, which is one of the big hitters, actually supported the provisions in the bill as they stood, the creation of a fee structure, interestingly enough. But I think I personally, the more I think about it, the more I become persuaded that in fact a proper inquiry must be done, and they themselves must find the ways that's maybe the kind of, there's another question whether we can ask a regulator like that to table their rules before Parliament, because that's the kind of thing we in the public interest can fight off. They mustn't feel that they can create fees that are anti-competitive or restrictive. I mean, it's the public must be served here.
I raised the question.
Whether can we, the way we can write into the law, when we want to see regulations, we can say we must approve them. Can one do something comparable with, I'm trying to remember what we did in ICASA. I suspect we did something like that in ICASA on one of the inquiries. Because we wrote inquiries into that law and said don't inquire and then you rule. But I suspect we did say bring that. On fees and the minister, I think, is one of the many examples that just puts in fact as a problem. So that you're already in trouble, as you said.
What happens when you issue? What happens? They go on charging fees they charge now until that investigation is completed and approved by Parliament.
First of all, I have a number of issues. First, 435A. I mean, my understanding is you can't prescribe fees. That involves the issue of the Competition Commission. So to say fees as may be prescribed is already seeming to contravene the Competition Regulations, because you can't say, you can say a minimum, as far as I understood it. No, a maximum, sorry, not a minimum. So that's one issue. Second issue is, if we say now there's no definition of legal services, is it then possible to interpret 35.1 in the alternative as saying that legal practitioners will be governed by these fee structures, but if paralegals decide to go and do any of this other work, then they can both live their lives? I'm asking, because you just said now there's no definition of legal services because you wanted to confine it into litigation, right? So if there's no definition of legal services and it's only really the litigation stuff that you say that only legal practitioners can do, that's in convincing and whatever. Any other legal services provided by people who aren't registered legal practitioners can actually charge for it any amount that they feel like, because they won't be regular. Which is surely not what we're intending to here. Now the other thing I want to know is law clinics and legal aid, is the purpose for putting those in just for recovering costs? Because obviously not going to cost, is that for when they work? And then I also don't agree with Steve Scott on the issue of litigious non-litigious. Why, just because someone negotiates a complex merger, they should be able to charge a fortune, whereas if you have to litigate on the complex merger agreement, then you can't. And also, you know, legal advice is one of the most basic issues of access to justice. And that's very often people need to get the advice in the beginning before they can even decide if they have a case or whatever, and they aren't even able to call that. So that is really, that's integral. So I don't agree that there should be any matters not known.
Thank you.
And I don't see why there's no scope in here for there to be differential tariffs in respect of certain matters. You know, if you're saying you're dealing with a multinational complex matter involving millions of dollars or something, that you can then charge a higher tariff. Or, I mean, I don't see that that's prohibitive in terms of this law.
So we've got a lengthy submission from Addison and Adams about intellectual property and the difficult and of evaluating and costing the work that they do that involves patent law, that involves science, that involves engineers, the implications of that, and they argue for a sector specific determination of fees if it's going to happen at all. Mm-hmm. Now, it just illustrates the difficulty of having a one-foot-fits-all, one-shoe-fits-all tariff when it comes to non-litigious work. I can understand that Judge's work, there's a precedent of setting this be a tariff for litigation, days in court, preparation, perusal. It's much easier to determine. But when you start involving in non-contentious work, where you've got a deep pocket client that needs a patent registered, that requires much work that will stand for the next 20, 30 years, that cannot be the same as going to another attorney to draft a simple contract. They are vastly different. And so that is why I have, I stand by what I say, that it's not going to be easy for particularly the rules board to determine what those patent attorneys, what those merger and acquisition attorneys should charge, what that fee structure should be. So at the moment, it is the market determines that, and that would adhere, that would agree with what the Competition Commission says should happen. The main issue of access to justice comes when it comes, when it relates to litigation. That is the key thing. Access people, so they can't go to court, they can't litigate. That's the main cost issue. So, Chair, just again, have a look at that. It's LPB 41. A strong argument is made in that particular sector of the complexity of determination of fees for that one area, and I'm sure it would apply to different areas of the law when one starts going into that, particularly when it comes to non-litigious matters. Jim. Thank you.
That's
possibly
not
Thank you, Chair. Chair, in general, one of the advantages of the Rules Board, as we said, is that they would comply with the Competition Commission's requirement that fees aren't set by competitors. So in other words, even if counsel were to make recommendations or launch an investigation, possibly when it comes to the legality of making the fees, it won't comply with this requirement of the Competition Commission currently. So it's something to keep in mind, we would suggest. And then secondly, the criteria in the alternative option we propose do take in account importance, significance, complexity, volume of work. So possibly the Rules Board could utilize a committee to advise it on sectoral fee setting, because I think it would be obvious that there can't be an hourly tariff or all work for all practitioners.
We have accepted in principle that unlike the present situation where attorneys practice establish practices on their own and so on, we accepted in principle that now attorneys and advocates can be establish practices, and we can even go as far as including quitters, accountants, and well, I don't know what term was that you use, multi-sectoral. Now how will that affect what is interesting? That was what struck me. I realize it's going to be complex and complicated. I realize that because the accountant is going to say to the accountant, the manager is me. Similarly, the architect. I foresee this is going to be a difficult one. Mr. Dyer?
The suggestion by Honourable Scott to have a third option in the investigation, just not here, but I would argue that it should be an add-on. It shouldn't be an option. Irrespective of what we do with clause, we must do an investigation similar to 3411. It shouldn't be an add-on. It shouldn't be an option clause. It should be, we must do this anyway. This is so important just from...
And we should put it under...
We should put it under 35 in similar terms to 34.11. Because
yeah.
I think a strong case is made out, and as the matter has been debated by the committee, it's such a complex issue that it requires some investigation anyway. And my request would be for the committee to consider having it as a separate action in 35 and not an option.
And is there any way of assuring the competition, as much as Mr. Dyer's proposal that the
I don't know what's going to achieve. We know what the causes are. The causes are people need to make money. Some people don't earn enough money. And some people don't regard it as a priority to pay legal fees. They'll go pay their doctors, they'll go pay the TV, they'll go pay DSTV, but the lawyers have blocked, and that's a lot of the problem. Well, the lawyers also expected to maintain a certain professionalism.
Doesn't this clause have to do with access to justice mainly? Now, it said a legal practitioner, juristic entity, or legal aid South Africa. Now, legal aid South Africa covers a certain group of people, from unemployed to earning X amount of money. So they're already covered for criminal as well as civil matters. I don't know about family law. To some extent, I think yes. So they're already covered. Not entirely, depending on the amount of money that they earn. So if we talk about access to justice, I just think that we need to be specific which category of people are we talking about. Because it's not, I mean, the first thing when you think about access to justice, you think of the unemployed people, you think of, or is it only me?
That legal aid covers what we refer to as the insurance. Okay. And they have to qualify in terms of the means test. Okay. The difficult lot is those people who fall just outside that category and are not affluent. There's a huge, enormous number who fall into that category. We just can't afford it. Who just really very thought that I may have to go to court creates all kinds of stresses and pressures. Because they know, I have to go to the bank and say to the bank, please give me an overdraft, and worry now, what is the manager going to say, what is it for?
Okay, but if you talk about that category, surely we're not talking about commercial clients, and I'm talking about banks as such, being a client, corporate. So if we talk about mergers and things like that, I don't see how they can fall in this category, and that's why I said I think we must also be specific when we say access to justice, when we talk about the fee structure, who are we really referring to? Because I mean, as a bank cannot be regarded as a client that cannot afford certain, I mean, that's our assumption. I'm just saying they don't, as a bank, as an entity, don't get involved with criminal matters. I mean, it's not an individual. No. But I mean, you understand what I'm saying? So that's what I'm saying. I think that to some extent we must also just be specific. Who are we targeting? Who do we have in mind when it comes to access to justice and the specific fee structure?
So in addition, should we not allow just the possibly exceptional cases that I've been dealing with, the Adams and Adams situation, and then
mergers and acquisitions that the client should have the right to contract out. Now, doctor, you can go and see a top specialist if you want to, if you can afford it. So that, in the case of those exceptional clients with patent law, why shouldn't they say, I'm a client, I'm prepared to pay more for this, why should I be? And maybe we need to look at, and that was recommended by Weber Wentzel as well, the right to contract out. That's the first point. The second point is the existing Contingency Act. I raised this previously. That would also have to be looked at by the rules board when they are determining the tax, because the Contingent Act allows you to contract for, what's it, 25%, which is a form of a tariff, I presume, as well. So it's already that in existence. But I think at the very least we need to look at, I like the suggestion of the add-on, as well as the possibility of parties being allowed to contract out of the fee structure should they so wish.
I think it's a good idea in principle. I'm just concerned that, maybe if it's up to the client to contract out. But, I mean, what happens with the doctors is they will just contract out. So then you really don't have a choice at all. And that's my concern. I mean, you go try and find any doctor, they're all contracted out. So otherwise, you'd go to the local clinic, stand in the queue from 5 o'clock in the morning, or you really just don't actually have to. That's my only concern.
Critical point is the medical profession has no fee structure. It's only what a medical aid suggests and whether they are contracted in. So there's no statutory determination that I understand for the medical profession at all. It's only because there is no, most people have got medical aid that use private practice, private medical profession.
My problem is that the effect could be that is in any event anti-competitive because the attorneys will stand together and say, well, we will contract them out.
I would imagine, and these are my initial thoughts, that we will not be able to contract out of the fee scales in teachers.
Yeah, I'm thinking about knowledge.
Which was yesterday,
yeah,
the knowledge.
Yeah,
so that's the classic
reason.
We can bring a fee.
All right, we've agreed then that there must be this investigation by the person. We need to provide that this to discuss it.
What exactly are we wanting to be investigated? What outcomes are we wanting?
Justice
generally, including the reasons why people find it so difficult to afford legal fees.
Even talk about a procedure or structure to assist or to make those recommendations for.
Make the attorney say, well, for this kind of matter, you should charge X fee. But you go to court, and every time the court's not ready, and the prosecutor's not ready, and the magistrate's not there, that's not the attorney's fault. So why should they have to go wait their time in court for things that are beyond their control? So all those kinds of issues will no doubt come up. And a lot of the things that can avoid costs, I think, are systemic issues and within the system. And
proposed,
refer to the Constitutional Commission?
Yes.
So just that option that I was thinking of, I'm not sure how that would fit in with the investigation, but that something along the lines of clients of legal practitioners are allowed or must be allowed to contract out to the fee structures for non-litigious matters. How does that sound? Just at the top of my head, just as something that we can bandy about. So that's the client, it's not the attorneys. Clients of legal practitioners will be allowed, must be allowed to contract out of the fee structure for non-litigious matters. But that's the client's choice. Yes, but that's presupposing what the investigation brings out. So it's, we've got to list the cart before the horse, but I just want to concretize my thoughts on trying to address the concerns raised by Adams and bigger parties. So it comes from the client side. They say we're prepared to pay more. It will help because it's then open competition. The clients say, well, we prepared to pay more. It will
take that determination into consideration?
What determination?
Competition Commission's
concern. No, I don't think the Competition Commission is concerned to increase competition in practice. They don't like fixed tariffs. They don't like fees setting. So this will enhance the argument that this complies with the competition requirements, that there is an openness here that the clients can say, but in certain circumstances, the market determines, I'll pay more for my services.
Or less.
Yeah.
Attorney, well, I'm charging $25,000. And we're saying, no, anything is currently, that's the position.
It was both ways, and that is perfectly.
You're not allowed to charge below a certain fee.
But now remember, I was talking about non-litigious matters now, because Mr. Dyke correctly argued that for litigious matters, you've got your tariff that is set by the rules board, and that is accepted in litigation. It's something we need to develop further, the arguments around that. At the very least for non-litigious matters, that, and then we can look at that for litigious matters as well, because it can move both ways.
Well, that's what the Competition Commission is saying in this document, that you are wrong, you need people that are in the profession to set a minimum and not allow legal practitioners to charge below
them.
But how do they work in cases such as the General Bar Council said that, for example, in the Marikana case, the advocates are charging a reduced rate, a substantially reduced rate. I mean, that's not litigious. That's not said by any parent, but the Commission. So you, as an advocate, can say, I'm charging an attorney. And you say, but you will not be able to recover. It's the issue of recovery of costs. That's what we're talking about. If you charge your own client, you can say, I'm not charging you anything. Or if you want.
The whole debate is about the party and party costs and the attorney and time costs that we spoke about some time back. And that whole
So we agree that the council will conduct this investigation.
And that we can draw some options around this.
already in that case, just say yes. This is going to be, I'm not sure about whether what I'm just going to do it, but if I forget this, it's not this. You see, I can understand the big company is saying what they said in their submissions. They only want to be, this is our turn, and they are. Essentially, that's what they're saying.
But they're saying the clients will have to pay it.
Yes, they would say that.
And Adam, you know, so.
They would say it. Sure, but in that case, it's your choice. See, and that's where you, that decision rests with you.
Yes, but what I'm saying is, if I know client attorney is charging this amount and attorney Y is charging more, I might think I want to go to attorney Y because I might get better services, whether it's correct or not.
Now that choice is left to you.
Point what Steve is making, if I as the client then decide on to pay more, then I should be able to do that.
Yeah.
Yes. The danger of my proposal when it comes to the litigious matter is that you have the situation that you face with the common law contracts that are over and above what the contingency acts are, and that is be struck down by the courts now. So if what my proposal is applicable to litigious matters, it can introduce that concept of new contracting along those lines which may be in excess. But my wording is trying to put it on the side of the client, and it's not as strong with litigious matters, but non-litigious matters, it's much stronger. With litigious matters, set tariffs, the contingency act applies, and there's already a fine against such contracts if I would draw the parallel between what I'm proposing and common law contracts. But that's for litigation. But non-litigation, you can, surely, you can, there's no set tariffs at the moment, there's no, you should be able to go to whoever you want, you might want less, your point is very valid. Am I on the right track?
Mm-hmm.
Is there a question? Okay.